Well, this is November the 9th, and this is Steve Weatherby of the University of Victoria, and I'm here with Major General A.J. Tedley, interviewing him about his career and his wartime experiences at his home in Sydney. So I'm going to lead off with some very basic questions. I'm going to ask you more or less about the extent of your career. So you could say, tell us first of all, when you enlisted, at what age, and what rank you had right at the beginning of your career.
In 1939, I was in New York City when Canada declared war on Germany. I rushed home and I joined up the 17th Duke of York Hussars, which was the only cavalry regiment that was recruiting in Montreal at the time. But they were on the, I forget the name of the force, but it was not the permanent force. They were guarding bridges and doing things of that nature. In June of 1940, they were looking for officers in the Royal Montreal Regiment, which was a regiment that had gone overseas in the Christmas season of 1939, and I had been recommended as a student for the officer candidate school, or that isn't what it was called in those days, but it was called the POTS class, Provisional Officers Training School. And that's how I became a commissioned officer. I think I was commissioned in June of 1940.
And you were how old?
I'd be 23.
Okay. Skipping forward, yep. How old were you when you retired, and what rank?
55, as a major general. Right. Retirement.
And what year was that?
In 1971.
Now, there is a lot of that's been written up about the primitive state of training in the first of the war, and people training with mock weapons or very old weapons. Recalling that training period, was there anything useful or worthwhile that happened to me?
I think I should make a definite statement that had I gone on to do a doctorate at the university, I already had the title for my dissertation, which was Canada, Always Willing, Never Ready. And the state of the Canadian Army in 1939, when I joined it, was such that it was a disgrace to our governments of this country. And as a historian or as a historical buff, the same thing repeats itself time and time over history. And the more I study the history of the Canadian forces, the more convinced I am that if we are really sincere about putting forces in the field that can get things done, we should have a general mobilization. And being a Quebecois, I know the word conscription is a very bad one, but regardless of that, we've got to conscript everything we require, prosecute the war properly. And I think that that is one of the major reasons that we were so weak in 1939. It had not been for a small cadre of people in various regular regiments, we would be in terrible shape. And as far as equipment is concerned, it's ludicrous, actually, but even when I was commissioned, we weren't given binoculars, we weren't given a sidearm, we weren't given a compass. We had to go out and buy them ourselves and get compensated for them. I haunted a tremendous number of pawn shops in Montreal to get myself equipped to be an officer in, which was then a machine gun regiment. As far as training is concerned, I wrote in the memoir that case of the blind leading the blind, because I had been at university in technical schools before the war, when the sub-teacher bureaucrats were being mechanized, or mechanicalized, as the president was, they had me lecture on the combustion engine, the internal combustion engine, on physical training, as a trooper, training other troopers, because we didn't have any training circles in the middle.
So, was anything, did anything useful happen? Was there anything accomplished that was worthwhile in terms of the formation of an army?
Once again, it's the manpower shortage.
Mm-hmm.
We had only a handful of people, actually, in what was called the NPAM in those days. And some of them were extremely well trained, but once again, that training had been done by that little handful of regulars that we had from the various regiments that were on the active list. And I have recalled on many occasions that I learned more from some old QMSIs and SMIs from the cadre than I ever learned at Staff College or National Defense College or any place else. These were people who were beautifully trained, but there were so few. So, absolutely.
And what was the regiment that you ultimately went into Normandy with?
Well, that's a story in itself, you see. There were so short of reinforcements for the people that were going or slated to go to Normandy that they had to break up some regiments to get the necessary flow of recruits. So the Royal Montreal Regiment, which had become the 32nd Reconnaissance Regiment, was one of the regiments that was broken up. And from there, I moved over to the British Columbia Regiment. And here is one of the great problems I found. I was a quite well-trained machine gun officer, and a very well-trained reconnaissance officer. But I'd never been in a tank in all my life, and I never thought I ever wanted to be in a tank all my life. And I'm told that you were no longer a reconnaissance officer, you were going to go to the British Columbia Regiment, which is the 28th Armored Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I became a tanker.
And how long before you actually went over to Normandy and saw action, did you get on your first tank?
Wonderful question. Along with other people who came from the 32nd Reconnaissance Regiment, we were sent to Bovington for a 3-week course, and to Lulworth for a 4-week course, one on driving and maintenance of the tank and the other on the gunnery portion of the tank. And they were the two schools. No training in tank tactics or anything of that nature, but the fundamentals of how a tank operated and how it learned to drive it all day.
On its own.
And all about the gunnery and so forth. But that's 7 weeks training in total. Went back to the regiment then, and they took a bunch of us who had arrived from the Royal Montreal Regiment, and they sent us to the tank delivery squadron of the British Columbia Regiment, which was part of the Elgin Regiment. And we went to Normandy at the same time as the regiment, on the same ship and so forth, but instead of going into action right away as the regiment was supposed to, we were siphoned off to the flank and waited. Of course, we didn't have very long to wait because the British Columbia Regiment got slaughtered very early on in their first major engagement. So the next morning we were all in the British Columbia Regiment proper.
So,
of course, the funny thing is, a tragic thing is, here I am with 7 weeks maximum training in tank and not in tank warfare.
Just tank fundamentals.
Exactly. And here I am commanding squadron.
Do you think that your experience was unique, or was that emblematic of what was going on in the months preceding the D-Day?
Well,
people being shifted around.
Yeah, could I put this in a different context? The best officers that I served with early on in the war, that war I'm talking about, the Normandy campaign, were people who had been in Italy and had been brought over, or some that had been Northwest Europe, North Africa. And they were the only people with modern war experience. And of course, fighting a tank in Italy and fighting a tank in Northwest Europe is a difference between chalk and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But at least they had the knowledge of what took place in tank battles and so forth. I can name a few, but Ned Amy is the one that comes to mind, first of all, because he was an excellent officer. And he ended up commanding the Grenadier Guards. Montreal.
Was he in your regiment for a while?
He was an RMC boy, and I forget what regiment he was with in Italy, but when he came over, and one I remember very well was an officer in the Royal Montreal Regiment who had gone to North Africa on exchange, and when he came, he was a great help to us until he got wounded, because he had experience.
So without any tactical training, you go into action. Do you have a little meeting beforehand, and your leader says, well, you guys will go over here, like an impromptu football play? Or?
You go into the regiment called when the colonel has been killed and three of the four majors have been killed in the battle the day before you arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo, who's to tell you?
Right. So you're improvising tactics on your own?
You learn by experience and experience alone. There's no way to run an army.
Well, I'd just like to ask you a little bit about the organization of the division. What division were you in?
Well, I was the 4th Canadian Armored Division.
Okay. And so were the armored regiments themselves in their own brigade, or were they was everybody simply under the division?
No. There was the armored brigade, which eventually was an extremely good one, by the way. Later, at the end of the war, I think it was excellent. And then there was the infantry brigade. The Army Division in those days had one infantry brigade and what was called a motorized infantry brigade and one tank brigade.
And were the tank regiments, were you assigned to specific infantry regiments, or did you switch around?
We switched around, but in most cases, as far as I can recall, I spent more time supporting the Algonquins and the Lincoln and Welland regiments. They were both regiments within 10 brigade.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, here again you say supporting. Armored regiments aren't supposed to be supporting infantry. They're supposed to be fighting an armored war. And one of our very best tank officers had an expression that he had even on his desk, which is, if you use them one at a time, you lose them one at a time. And this is what happens when you're detached to an infantry organization. You say, we'll assist you shooting you onto the objective and things of that nature, sometimes quite successfully. But that is not the basic use of armor.
But back then, when you got moved up from the Elgin Regiment to the BCRs,
yes,
you didn't know any of that, I suppose.
No,
no tactical.
No tactical.
Well, there, were you involved in any of the large operations like Tractable or Totalize?
Totalize.
And that was that kind of how would that fit in with your model of how armored warfare should happen? A very big operation with lots of tanks at once.
Could you shut the machine off just for a minute? Because I'll go and find something that might give some help.
Yeah. Well, General, we were just talking about Totalize, and you were explaining how it was a massive confusion. The first time that something on such a scale and with some of these techniques, the first time they've been tried. Does something on that scale match, however, your what you believe armored operations ought to attempt?
I do not like to say that Canadian High Command knew very little about how to operate an armored, or how to operate in an armored battle.
You do seem to be saying that.
Yes. And as a consequence, you get yourself in a position of saying that the American cavalry had the real spirit of the White Arm, the way they did their particular maneuvers, as opposed to the rather pedestrian way in which Ken did ours. And whether you can blame that all on the Canadians is not true, because we were fighting in Montgomery's army, which was a very pedestrian army compared to the ones that were fighting on our right flank. And I think, not being disloyal, I think the Americans produced better armored soldiers than we did.
Commanders. And tactics as well.
Well, everybody says Patton was a great general. He was not my favorite person, but he certainly knew how to use tanks.
Well, there was a different, the British seemed to think of tanks as infantry support more, and Americans were thinking fighting the Indians in the West.
In a nutshell, that's right.
But back to Totalize, it did seem to be a large-scale, ambitious operation. Was it too ambitious or not ambitious enough?
There's never enough. As the Russians used to say, more and more guns. That's what we mean.
Okay. The operation that saw the decimation of the regiment that you joined right after that, we also discussed that while we were off tape. I'm wondering if you could characterize what happened to it upon reflection, as the fog of war, bad luck, or a kind of systemic problem, emblematic of a systemic problem of the Canadian Army at that point.
If we have a checkpoint, I would say all of the above.
Okay.
Right? But basically, poor map reading, reporting where you were when you weren't, and calling for artillery support in a completely wrong place, and getting slaughtered by a very superior Russian, no, not Russian, German general, Kurt Meyer, who knew exactly what was going on, obviously, and picked the tanks off one by one.
In terms of not knowing how to read a map, is this an individual problem, or do you think that the Canadian Army did enough in England in terms of training commanders to move large groups of units from this place on the map to that place? Was there enough training for everybody?
I'm sure that moving from point A to B in Britain during the bright sunlight days is something we could do with great skill, reporting exactly where we were minute by minute. Mm. But during the night and in the fog of battle, we were not great map readers. And that's why I'm pleased to see now that we have position indicators and so forth. We'll be able to tell you where they really are.
Well, I presume that Simmons seemed to have seemed to like the idea of night attacks.
Yes.
Was the Canadian Army trained in night movement or night attacks?
When there was artificial moonlight, where they beamed the searchlights off the cloud, low cloud, we maneuvered quite well. But certain nights, I remember particularly the attack to cut off the road, the first foray into the Netherlands was to capture Bergen op Zoom. And my particular tank squadron had to cut the road between Bergen op Zoom and Tilburg, I think it was. And we attacked during the night and didn't lose a tank. But I thought that was more by luck than good judgment, because surely they could have popped out foxholes all around us as we were traveling, with the Panzerfaust not dissolved. But maybe there were so many of us, we were massed there again. In this case, the whole squadron with two clubs. Maybe we got away with it.
Now, you mentioned meeting officers that have been sent to North Africa or Italy, or at least brought back from Italy.
Yes.
Precisely with the idea of bringing their experience.
Exactly.
And was that useful? And what kind of experience did they bring that you found useful?
I found that the fellow who had been in North Africa, his name was Austin McBride, until he got wounded, I was his battle captain and his 2IC, and we had far more success under him, short-term success, day after day battles, than I had under any other of the majors in high school.
When you went over to France, did you know about the superiority of German tanks in terms of armor and firepower?
Yes. Yes and no. The point is that we had heard that the German tank, that's a tank plural, but were superior to us, but we had more of our own. By that time, we had converted to the Sherman. And then we Sherman with the 75 millimeter, we went up to the 17 pounder, went from troop to. We were able to, by the end of the war in Normandy, I think we had much more confidence in our tanks than we had when we started off. Because we had been able to find techniques of putting catching parts of track and some response and so forth, so we were so vulnerable to German attack. We had learned a lot about, we were issued with going maps. Going maps were things that were supposed to show you what would take a tank on the ground in front of you. A lot of people forget that we were issued with these. And if you could read them properly, then you would say, well, instead of going this way, we're going to go around this flank, because according to the going map, the ground is far and there was marshy over here. And if you paid attention to the going marks, and you could use them if that is the direction you wanted to go, of course, they were a great help.
So the going maps would have been the product of intelligence?
Yes.
Would they be regimental, or would this be divisional intelligence?
No, actually, I think a great deal of it was from air reconnaissance being interpreted by engineers. I couldn't tell you. It might be an interesting study to see where the going maps really came from. They were a great help to me. I know in one particular action, I was able to hop out of my tank and look at the going map and sort of direct the tanks in that particular direction.
Well, you've mentioned the word sponson a couple of times.
Yes.
So what is a sponson?
Oh, just the side of the tanks.
Over the wheels and the frame. Okay. And you said that you learned techniques by the time you were out of Normandy. What techniques had you learned to deal with German tanks?
Let me give you an anecdote. I'm in my anecdotes now. 90. We used to be great for blitzing up the highways and capturing all sorts of villages and so forth when there was no great resistance. But when we got onto an area where it was obvious that the Germans had well spotted defensive positions,
which was usually like this,
yet you couldn't go up the hill, so you'd have to start the formations. And this is a true story. I remember coming up on the blower and saying, "All station, Charlie 1, uprise now," and that was a code word for forming box formation off the highways and into the plains and so on. And I got back, off station, whatever it was, Charlie 1, we'll call it Charlie 2, we'll call it Charlie 3. "Jesus Christ, tactics at last!"
Said somebody.
Yeah. That, in other words, when you're sort of on the roads all the way, making lots of progress and looking good in the newspaper, by the way, Canada made so many miles a day against very limited opposition. And one thing we found out very early on was that if they were going to block you, they would block you sufficiently until you did a big deployment, wasting your time deploying, trying to get around it, and then when you put in the attack, they'd be
gone.
Like a will of the wisp. But paid for that very dearly, and the road between Les Essarts and Monet in Normandy, where we lost quite a few tanks trying to battle our way up Saint-Yvon. And we got together enough artillery, was no guns on the ground, so you couldn't get any artillery support. Then we got the artillery support up and we made another attack.
There was nobody then. Did you suppose when the Germans did stay there with a screen of anti-tank guns and so forth, how did you learn to get around or get through such obstacles?
With difficulty. Once you would try prod in one particular direction, hit something, try a flanking movement, try another flanking movement, depending on how much in way of armor you had at your disposal. And sometimes you could get around the block, but when you were fighting against the enemy who had been fighting armor for quite a few years at that time, they were not easy to surprise them by going around the flank. They would have that flank covered too if it was, yes, they also had going maps to show you where you could go.
Well, how important to your men, the men of your regiment, was the knowledge that the German tanks were superior? Is it something that you talked about, that worried you, that you joked about as a way to cover your concern?
When we were under 30 Corps rather than Canadian Corps, Sir Brian Horrocks was our Corps commander. And it was during that time when we were in 30 Corps that they did the upgunning to 17-pounders as opposed to the 75-millimeter gun. And we only got them originally one per troop, I think it was. You have to look at the... But I remember Sir Brian Horrocks, and this man is a lieutenant general, in the tank park with my squadron, saying, "I realize that we've been knocked out of action many, many times because of the tank. Now you've got something that can penetrate the German army." The morale of the troops just went up like that. I don't know, and this is not whether we had Canadian Corps commanders up to tell us anything like that. But I do know that the morale of my squadron just went up through the roof as a result of a lieutenant general coming and telling me, "Fellas, you've got something now that can beat the German tanks."
there's been a criticism that I've run across in history books about the Canadian Army, that it was in the British Army, I guess, as well, that they were artillery addicted.
Very much so. More guns. That's also Russian.
Was there any other solution? I guess the Americans did the Americans, for example, push with more vigor with their tanks and break through?
Yes, but the point is that you've also got to plan your attack properly. But once you get it going, you've got to keep going. But this idea of, oh gee, it's a piece of cake, you know, we go dashing off, and that doesn't work. You've got to have the troops right down to the last tank commander, and hopefully he's going to look after his own crew to tell him exactly what's up. They've got to know what they're doing and why they're doing it. And to do this takes some time. You see, it's like a stately pavan, really. You have the div commander giving his orders, and he gives them to the brigade commander, and he gives them to the regimental commanders, and they break down.